So our first one is by Professor Fran Bagnall, a professor from the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics at the University of Colorado Boulder. Fran is a co-investigator on the New Horizons mission to Pluto and also to the corresponding NASA project to Jupiter called Juno. She's the lead of the plasma sciences investigations there. I think we're in for a real treat. Fran has given some wonderful talks at the University of Sydney on Friday, and she will be much more eloquent and interesting than me. So without further ado, Professor Fran Bagnall.
Good. Huge pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. And I am going to tell you about two missions, each of which has taken about 20 years, and I've got 30 minutes, so I'm going to charge through and tell you about the New Horizons mission to Pluto that flew past Pluto last July, and then the Juno mission to Jupiter that is now in orbit, having had its successful orbit insertion on the 4th of July this year. So I started working on the Pluto mission back as a young faculty at the University of Colorado when a graduate student, Alan Stern, came up to me and said, "Now that Voyager is completing its exploration of the outer solar system, why don't we go to Pluto?" And I was sort of surprised, but I said, "Sure, let's think about it." And so we started on embarking on trying to get a mission to Pluto. It was quite a long effort to convince NASA and the taxpayer to go to Pluto. We started off, we had a bunch of studies, but very important along the way was the discovery of the Kuiper Belt. So we weren't just going to look at Pluto, the last object of the solar system. We were going to look at the largest of many, now thousands of objects, which are in orbit around the sun, very varied, different kinds, and keys to understanding the formation of the solar system. And now that we're looking at exoplanets, realizing that planets migrate and move around and kick things about. And so Pluto is not just the last planet of the solar system, it's indeed a example of a huge population out there in the Kuiper Belt. So here are the things we knew about Pluto before we set out. We knew roughly their sizes, the relative distance. We knew it had a moon at that time, a very large moon, Charon, actually relatively close to the planet. And we knew that it was very small, though, compared with the size of the Earth. For relative masses, here are the example of 1 to 457, the Pluto to Earth size, and then Pluto's moon Charon being an eighth the size of Pluto. So we knew that. We also knew roughly what their colors were. Charon was gray. Pluto had this sort of orangey-browny tinge, which was a big puzzle. We also knew that Pluto had a big variety of albedos, from very bright to very dark. And we also knew that the surface was exceedingly cold. So minus 233 Celsius, we knew that everything on the surface would be frozen. So we started off, actually this was a proposal, mission proposal, competitive bid in 2001. We were successful, we started building the spacecraft, testing it, 2004, 2005, and then finally launched in January of 2006. So what do we have on this spacecraft? We have a bunch of cameras, a long-range, high-resolution camera, black and white, color, wide-angle, the RALF instrument. We have two plasma instruments, PEPSI and SWAP, a radio. We use the radio signal from the communication dish to probe the atmosphere, as well as the UV spectrometer, and I'll show you examples of what they saw in a bit. But the most important of all of the instruments on the spacecraft is the student dust counter, designed, built, tested, operated, and the data analyzed by students at the University of Colorado. So very proud of this instrument that was added on and has been taking data and continues to take data in the outer solar system. So, of course, we were about to launch the spacecraft in 2006, when in the meantime, the Hubble Space Telescope found four more moons. And so we now have a whole system of five moons and a planetary object to look at. So this is the trajectory through the system. It took us 9.5 years to get there. I hesitate because it was a very long time. And in that time, we were planning this mission. What you will notice is that these time ticks is moving at 14 kilometers a second, or 33,000 miles an hour. That sounds a lot more dramatic. But it moves through the system very fast. When the period of about 4 hours, we've moved through the entire system, and this is after 9.5 years of getting there. So we knew we didn't have a lot of time to design. We had to design a mission that would fly through, do all the things we wanted to, collect all the data on board, and send it back. Now, we got a 4.5 hour one-way communication time, so round trip of 9 hours. And so there's no joysticking this spacecraft. This spacecraft is a robot. We tell it what to do. We hope it does it correctly. And then it turns back and it communicates with the Earth. And it's communicating at 3 kilobits per second. So the average cell phone, even a cheap one, is probably about 50 megabits per second. So it actually took the best part of 9 months to get all the data back at that rate. So we store all the data on board. It has a memory about the size of a large memory stick, and then it sends the data back over a longer period of time. So what do we do while we're waiting for the data to come back? Well, we do what most people do. We take selfies. And so the day of flyby, while we were waiting to hear about the data, we were taking pictures and doing a lot of publicity and talking to the press and so on and so forth. And here is a celebration of the fact that this mission is about a third women, a good group of people, and had all sorts of roles, including the deputy project scientist and the mission operation manager, who was the woman who announced to us that indeed the spacecraft was full of data and was healthy and alive. So what did we see? Well, we saw a very complex surface, all sorts of very interesting terrains, which we named after various explorers and science fiction characters. But the really amazing fact is that this is a really bizarre surface covered with all sorts of very interesting geological things. Very many of them are comparable to sorts of features we see here on Earth, and many others which we have no analogs here on Earth because of the cold temperatures and strange behavior of ices that we don't have on the surface of the Earth. So ice, ice, ice is the story of this surface. Much of it is water ice, which acts like a rock at these temperatures. It is very solid, it's very brittle. And then on top, we have a layer of nitrogen ice, CO, and methane ice. Those are, in fact, much softer and denser and flow. And water ice, in fact, floats in the nitrogen ice. We'll see some icebergs in a bit. Notice that with a density a little less than that of about 2 grams per cubic centimeter, so it's about a third ice and two-thirds rock, but the outermost 300 kilometers is water ice. So when you're looking at this surface, it may look like rock, but in fact it is water ice acting like rock, very solid, very dense in that respect. There may be, possibly, a thin layer of liquid water, but it's deep down, unlike the oceans on Europa, which are deep and not so far from the surface. Here, we believe if there's any water, it's very deep below the surface, and so very little possibility of there being life at these temperatures and pressures. So what do we see? Well, we can use the spectroscopic instrument to measure the surface ices. We can see there's nitrogen and methane that are closely confined to various regions. The water tends to be away from the regions where we see nitrogen and methane. Methane tends to be the ice that we think is sublimes and then is deposited again as frost on the higher elevations. But in particular, you'll see that the Sputnik planum, that heart-shaped feature, is where the more volatile ices, nitrogen, methane, and CO, are deposited, whereas water is other places. And the water ice tends to be covered with some brown stuff. We don't know what that is exactly. So very notable is this Sputnik planet, which is indeed full of nitrogen ice. And we think this may well be an oblique impact crater that made a not exactly spherical impact with a coming in at an angle. And this was then filled with nitrogen ice. We think this nitrogen ice is convecting. It is low viscosity, even though it's relatively dense, and so it flows. Just like silly putty, if you put it in a ball on a surface, it will spread out. The same is true of nitrogen ice. It's is turning over with a time frame that's about 500,000 years. That's relatively short in geological time frames, but obviously quite long in every day. You're not going to see it flowing from day to day. But if you look at Sputnik Planum, and the picture above is from the Nature paper by Bill McKinnon recently, you can see that particularly when you enhance the contrast, you can see these cells, these polygonal features that are the turning over of ice from underneath. And you can look very hard, but you won't find any impact craters on this surface. It's relatively new, about 500,000 to 1 million years old, compared with some of the other areas that are much older and have impact craters. Here is an older region with a lot of water ice, and we think these are large icebergs, water ice floating in nitrogen ice. And these are huge. Notice that the vertical scale here shows that these are sticking up about 5 kilometers. So they're very large water ice mountains floating in this nitrogen ice. Lots of impact craters in the older areas, and the higher ground is covered with methane frost around the edges of these impact craters. You'll also see cracks across the surface where the water ice has expanded and cracked as it froze. Now, when we flew past, we were looking at the moons. We were taking all the pictures of the different moons, taking pictures of Pluto, and then we went behind and looked back at the sun as the sun went behind Pluto and then behind Charon, and we were able to measure the atmosphere by looking at the absorption of solar UV with a UV instrument and looking at the absorption of the communication signal as with the radio signal as the spacecraft went behind. So when we look at the solar occultation using the UV instrument, you can see that quite a long way out, about twice, 2.5 times the radius of Pluto, you can see that the UV signal was absorbed from the sun, and so this tells us that there's a substantial atmosphere extending quite a long way out. Pluto has a fairly weak gravity, and so the atmosphere is highly extended, even at the cold temperatures. And then close in, there's a big drop in the amount of sunlight coming through. And this is because we have, at Pluto, visible hazes. Now, this is a visible picture, and so there's absorption in visible and UV, as well as the radio, by these hazes at higher altitudes above the planet. And so you can see here, this is what it really looks like, a blue sky with Rayleigh scattering the same way the sky outside, and I believe the sun is now shining, that there's a blue sky outside here on Earth due to the same physical principle of scattering of sunlight, preferably in the blue part of the spectrum. And so, indeed, Pluto's atmosphere has hazes. Now, where do these hazes come from? Well, the idea is that you have UV sunlight, and it's about 1,000 times weaker than the sunlight that we have here at Earth. But there's enough to break up the methane, and which then comes together to make bigger molecules, such as ethylene and acetylene, or even bigger hydrocarbons. We call those tholins, which are photolytic products of nitrogen, CO and methane that can be made in the lab, and here's an example in these test tubes. But we see on the surface that the old areas, such as Cthulhu, the very dark region to the left of the heart, you can see is covered in this brown, black, gunky, oily stuff, which is indeed this photochemical products that are coming out of the atmosphere. So oily hydrocarbons raining out and covering the surface with black gunky stuff. Now, of course, the younger areas, there's a turnover and fresh ice is there, and this is the area where there's no impact craters, young surface in the Tombo Regio, the heart region. And so what we're seeing is a geology where there seems to be older areas that have this brown accumulation of brown, gunky, oily material, and then younger areas that are bright, that have a fresh turnover of ice and ice and frost. And if you look carefully, you can see in these ice mountains, perhaps strata, where you have alternating layers of brown, gunky stuff and ice on top. So this geology was totally unexpected. No one really expected to see this small object have such complicated geology with active convection, with material raining out of the sky and covering up surfaces, alternating layers of frost and gunky material. So there's a lot of geological activity here, which we were not expecting, and some of it is pretty exotic. So here is my favorite picture from the flyby, and we see all sorts of features. It's when the sun has just about to set, and so you are seeing, you can see the hazes behind. You can see the flat area of Sputnik Planum where the fresh ice is turning over. You can see the big ice mountains, the water ice mountains that are sticking up, lit by the scattered light from the haze. Doesn't that look like a planet to you? So this is my favorite picture, and we have many others of really quite amazing surface. This is perhaps another of my favorites, which shows the fresh ice, perhaps dark material underneath the frost layers, and then a layer of brown material that has rained out on the top. So there's lots of pictures, lots of them, all available and made available immediately to the public. And if you're interested in the solar-wind interaction with the atmosphere, come see my poster later this week, tomorrow.